Okay, so what I was asked to talk about is the... There's lots of extras. I wanted to give a forest view of Judaism. So often we look at the trees and we see different parts of Judaism, but to see what the whole thing is about, that's what I hope to do in a few minutes. So we'll see if we can do it in half an hour or so and really give like a whole bird's eye view of really what is the plan of Judaism. So I'm taking some of the ideas really from quite a few places, but in case you ever feel like reading something about it, there's a book with this title called Master Plan, The Program Goals and Meetings of Judaism, which is written by Rabbi Aryeh Carmel, and it's actually, in a way, a Reader's Digest translation of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch's book, Horev, which was written in the 1840s approximately, and it was written for the thinking young Jew at the time, particularly those in Germany. It was written in German, those in Germany who were being heavily influenced by the nascent reform movement and by the budding scientific revolution and the fact that Jews were now accepted in society, not all the way, but enough to get into university and jobs. And there was a new wave of assimilation, especially among the young. And so Rav Hirsch set out to write a comprehensive view of Judaism so that the young Jew should know what it is that they're either leaving or should be going towards. It turns out it's relatively difficult to read. It's written in a beautiful German, which translates into a difficult English. And so Master Plan is the easy way to read it, if you're ever interested. Much shorter. But I'm going to mix it up with a bunch of different ideas, but I just wanted to give you kind of what this concept is. So what is Judaism about? If you really think about it, where do we come from? Coming from a whole different perspective. You know, it's interesting to think about even the names of the Jews. Do you know what Jews are called? There's four different names for us. Good names for us that the Torah uses. Who could name some of them?
Israelites.
Chosen. So chosen people is a description, but a name, right? So what did you say? Yehudim, Jews. Israelites, Jews. B'nai Israel, the same thing as Israelites. Hebrews. And there's one that's an extra gold star. Jeshurun or Yeshurun. Jeshurun. That's an extra gold star one. It's only three times, but it is our name also. And you sometimes hear like congregations are called B'nai Jeshurun or something like that, or Kehilath Jeshurun in Manhattan, KJ, or Das called Jeshurun, Yeshurun. Is that so? There's these four names. So the first name, though, is Hebrew, Ivri, and it comes from the root of other side, the root of avar, so which means past tense, or avera, which means transgression, but it has to do with the trans. Ivri is on the other side of something, and so Abraham and Sarah were named the first Hebrews, the first Ivri, because they came from the other side of the Jordan River. But it couldn't be that our name has stuck as Hebrew, because of the geographic location from whence our first Jews came. It has to have something much deeper than that for that to be our name today of Hebrew. So it really is that we're the other siders. We come from the other side of world opinion, right? We stand out alone. We have a totally different opinion about how everything works. It seems like today our opinion meshes nicely, but that's because we've influenced the whole world. And a lot of people are coming over to our way of thinking to the extent that it meshes with today's society, particularly Western society. But really, if you look at when the Jews first started out, we were alone in our thoughts. So we'll get to some of those thoughts, or we could even jump to some of them. Well, we'll get to some of them. But we were alone in those thoughts initially, with the whole world thinking quite differently than we thought. So the first thing is that we're not them. That's not enough to know who we're not, right? We have to know who we are, or what we stand for. So the second name of the Jew is Yehudim, right? Jews. And really, Yehudim, it comes from the fourth son of Leah. You know that Jacob had 12 sons, but he had four wives. So if you do the math, really, each wife should have three, right? Each wife should have three. But it didn't work out that way. So you know the whole Leah and Rachel switcheroo story, right? So Leah's feeling pretty poorly about her relationship with Jacob, but she conceives first. Even though Rachel's the most beloved, she conceives first, second, and third, and then fourth. So she names her children after how she's feeling. So the first one is named Reuven, because God sees my pain. I'm the hated wife. I'm in pain. I'm going to call him Reuven because, A, he sees it. The second one's named Shimon, from the word Shema. God hears my pain. I'm the hated wife. I'm feeling miserable. He hears me. The third one is named Levi. Like from the, it's the root, the same root as Levaya, which was a funeral, but really means to accompany the dead, right? So God is accompanying me in my pain. Feeling pretty rotten. Okay, so now she has her first three, right? But the fourth one, she's excited about, because that's
it's a pull away. I'm so sorry. I'll turn that down.
That's more than her share, and she's very thankful. She names the fourth one Yehuda. She says, "This time I'll thank Hashem. I have an extra one, and I'm excited about it." And it's considered to be the first time that that kind of thankfulness was expressed towards God in the world. So that's his name, is thank you. And also it means admit, to recognize that God's in charge. So it's thankfulness and a recognition. Lehodot is to thank and to admit. So, and when you say thank you for setting this up, you say, it couldn't be like this without you, right? Thank you. We admit that you did some work to make us comfortable. That's part of what thank you is. So thank you and admit goes together. So so that's us, the thankers. We are the thankers. So that's what we stand for. It's not enough to know who you're not and what you stand for. You have to know who you stand with, right? So who do we stand with, right? We're a nation. We're not called the B'nai Avraham. And as much as people will want to talk about the Abrahamic faiths, tell them that is not, you don't have to tell them, you should know. We are not three Abrahamic faiths. There's no such thing. It's not Christians, Jews, and Muslims all descended from Abraham, three Abrahamic faiths. We are not the children of Abraham. We are the children of Abraham, but that's not how we identify. You'll never hear Jews, except in the newspapers or anybody who's trying to do interfaith stuff, call us the B'nai Avraham. We're the B'nai Yisrael. Right, because Avraham was a very important thinker and really changed the course of human history if you think about how many people are influenced by his ideas. But he did not change the world because he was one guy with one wife, two kids, one followed and one didn't. That one...
So sorry, I thought I told you
that. He's so cute. That one had two children, one followed and one didn't. And one person's not enough to change the whole world. You actually need a critical mass of people thinking kind of the same thoughts, working together to make a big impact on the planet. So that was Jacob, who knew that there was going to be a group of 12 who would be the seeds of a nation who would create something big enough to make a critical mass that would change the world. So we're called the B'nai Yisrael, Jacob and Israel, the same person. We're called the children of Jacob, the children of Israel, because that's how we identify nationally. That's who we stand with. But the fourth name of the Jew, the extra credit one, right, Yeshurun, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch says, that's how we change the world, through being yeshar, straight, being totally honest, totally straight, and totally directed. And I was thinking about it one time when I was in Los Angeles. I saw the palm trees there. And we say in Shul on Shabbos, right, Tzadik Katamar Yifrach. Do you know that song? Tzadik Katamar Yifrach. Right? The righteous like a palm will flourish. What does that mean, the righteous like a palm will flourish? Why not like an oak tree? Oak trees are big and strong, and they give shade. Look at the palm trees. They're so skinny and tall. They're so flexible, too. Whenever you see television coverage of a storm, the palm trees can bend way over and recover because their roots are deep. They can hang on. Even in the tumultuous hurricane zone, palm trees are there, and they grow straight up. They're very directed, like a righteous person. No branches taking you off in different directions. Hi. No branches taking you off in different directions. They go straight, they're directed, and they shed their past. Right? They're constantly flourishing anew and letting go of the old. So that's how we accomplish who we're supposed to be, is by being straight, by being directed. But we're not there yet. That's an ideal, a goal for who we want to be. But as a group, we're not there yet. Well, hopefully we'll get there, but we're not there yet. So let's go back a little bit and see. So, okay, we have this program. As Jews, really, we are charged with changing the world. That's really what our job is. It's a double job. Jews have a double job. All human beings are created in the image of God. So all human beings have the job of transform self. Right? Transform self into as godly a human being as they can be. The more godlike one can become, the stronger relationship they can create with God, which means the more God they can receive. And if you think about your marriage, the closer you can become in your marriage, the more of the other person you actually bond with and can blend with and can receive from them and give to them. There's this connection that's very deep. The more you share, the deeper you are. And that comes with time and investment and engagement and activities shared that creates a strong bond. The more time we spend in relationship with God, the more God we can receive in our lives and permanently. So if we want to become godlike, so that's all human beings have that capacity. But as Jews, we have an extra job, and that's to lead the way for the rest of the world, that everybody should see through us how it's done. Right? So it's transform self, transform the world. Who knows how many Jews there are on the planet?
7 million?
7 million?
No, I thought 15.
I think somewhere in between, closer to 15 than 7. But I think it's somewhere between 12 and 14 is the question. Very small. We're way less than 1%. Right? So we're actually less than the statistical error in the calculation of the population of China. Right? We're hardly anything at all. Right? Imagine a cheese factory. I was born in Wisconsin, so cheese works for me. That's a parable. Okay? Imagine a cheese factory, and you're making cheese, and you have a vat about the size, like imagine this is a room, right? So a vat of milk about the size of this room here. How much rennet do you need in this vat of milk to make it curdle to turn into cheese?
Half a cup.
About half a cup, maybe even less. Yeah, very little.
I'm sorry, I just know.
It's good. You're right. You're right. It's very little. Compared to the quantity of milk, it's very little, right? And that's what makes all the difference, right? Jews are the rennet in the cheese of the world. We're a tiny amount of the population of the planet, but we make all the difference. We are the ones who change everything from the potential to what it could be. That's really our job, is to be that group of critical mass, a tiny amount, but the amount that makes the difference. Look at us. We're all over the place, all over the planet, all over the discoveries, all over the science, all over history. I mean, we make a difference wherever we go. That's our job, is to transform. So transform self, transform world. That is the role and goal of the Jew. So the question is, how do we do that? So that's what Judaism is about. So Judaism is really a comprehensive plan to accomplish both transform self and transform planet. Right? So really, we're created for, and I put this word just on the top, we're created for pleasure. That's really what we're here for, is for pleasure, which is why we all seek it so much. So the question is, what pleasure is the top pleasure? We're not going to really go into that for this class just right now. I'll just postulate that the best thing there is, well, I'll just ask you a quick riddle. It's really a Christian-based riddle. It's not a Jewish-based riddle because we don't believe in part of it, but I'll ask it to you anyway. What is better than God, worse than the devil? The rich have it. No, the rich need it. The poor have it. And if you eat it, you'll die. Better than God, worse than the devil. This is why it's not Jewish, because we don't believe in the devil. Better than God, worse than the devil. The poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die. Nothing! Right? So. Right? Nothing. Yeah. So if we want to say, what's the best of the best of the best that you could possibly, if you want to go like past chocolate, past a Maserati, personally, I like Bentleys better, but the old kind. I saw a Bentley today, real Bentley.
I see a lot of them today.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Here, there's Bentleys here. Yeah, but I don't like the modern ones. I was trying to think, what's the look with a modern Bentley? It's not pretty. Like a 1930s Bentley, that's like to drool for, I think. I mean, I saw one on the road and I realized I was dangerous driving. I'm like, oh, what a gorgeous car, right? Anyway, past a lovely car, past yummy chocolate, past a wonderful relationship, past fabulous nachas-filled children, pass a nation at peace, past a world at peace, what's better than that? And what's better than that is God. Right? There's nothing better than God. So if God wants to give us pleasure, the ultimate pleasure, the pleasure that God wants to give is God. So, right, that's what he wants to give us. So that's what we have souls for, souls to become receivers for godness. And we have this whole world to fine-tune using our physical tuning mechanism, to use our body to fine-tune our souls to be able to best receive God. And it's a whole world of workshops and experiences and choice points and engagements to tune and tune again, increase capacity and tune again, increase capacity and grow and increase capacity and tune again, so that by the time our soul leaves our body, it's quite transformed so that it could be in the biggest and strongest relationship possible with God for eternity. So we have this finite period to make that happen for eternal afterwards. So how does that work? Mitzvot, right? So we have mitzvot. So we're unique on the planet in that we actually have a physical plan of what to do. So you have to understand, why do we have this? As opposed to being faith-based, as you know, it doesn't matter what a Jew believes, they're a Jew, no matter what. And it's going to be interesting to find out when Mashiach comes, hopefully soon, around the corner. It feels like there's really electricity in the air at this point. But how many people are Jewish and just don't know it? Because all you have to do to be Jewish is be born of a Jewish mother, right? And you don't have to believe in a thing, right? So there's a lot of forgotten Jews on this planet. A lot of people who have no clue that they're Jewish, but were born of a Jewish mother, I had a babysitter in Long Beach, when I lived in Long Beach, Long Island, who I thought was Catholic. And she was the greatest. She was so good with the kids, and a lot of people sent to her. A lot of Jews and a few non-Jews, but she was just really gifted with the kids, really gifted. They loved going to her, Margaret. So, and she decorated the house like crazy for all the holidays. Anyway, one day she's telling me how she just loves people. She had such a Long Island accent. I love people from all over the world, any type of people. I just love them. She said, you know, I mean, I have somebody from Iran or Persia. I'm not sure what's the difference. And I have, it's funny like that, right? She says, and I have somebody from Russia, and I have like, and we have Jews, and we have Gentiles, like everybody. She said, no, my mother's mother was a Jew from Russia. I'm like, your what? Your mother's mother was a Jew from Russia? And she said, yeah. She came when she was a teenager. She married somebody Catholic. We had a daughter who married somebody Catholic, who had Margaret, who married somebody Catholic, who had a daughter who has no clue that she's Jewish. I said, Margaret, that makes you Jewish. I said, Margaret, you're Jewish. She said, I am. I said, you are. So, but there's a lot of Margarets. And there's a lot of Margaret's daughters who doesn't even know that her grandmother, that her mother's mother came from Russia as a Jew. Right? Because by the time it's her daughter, that's her great-grandmother. That's lost already. So there's a lot of Jews on this planet. A lot. A lot of people who hid and it just got lost. And a lot of people who assimilated and just got lost. So it'll be interesting to see how many there are. Meanwhile, it's fascinating to think about each one of us here, not me, because I did convert to Judaism, but each one of you, whoever was a Jew from birth, just think about this for a minute. You are a walking, talking miracle. Because it means that if you're here today identifying Jewish, it means that for 3,500 years, your family both survived physically and chose in every generation from Sinai until today. Right? There's a lot of glitches and a lot of people who were killed and a lot of people who chose out. But you're only here today because you are the child of so many people for 3,500 years that made it and chose to stay. So it's a pretty amazing thing. Now, if anybody else happens to be a Jew by choice, I'll tell you, you're also a miracle, so I'll just speak to myself, because you found the Jewish people. I mean, they're here today, and there's not that many, right? But you found and you chose in. So it's still a miracle, but it's an amazing thing. So what does it mean, though? Then we have this mitzvah program. So we have this thing that's not about our beliefs, that's about how you behave, right? So it does matter what you think, but it does matter what you think to make you Jewish or not. It matters what you do to transform your soul. A spiritual being is not dynamic. That's our understanding. A spiritual being is static. And a physical being is dynamic. It changes states, right? We're born, we grow, we age, we die. We're always changing. It doesn't remain the same at all. So with a dynamic physicality, and you put that together only by miracle with the spiritual self, you can then transform spiritual by the dynamic dimension of the blend with the physical. So that's the point of physical and spiritual being together. Because if you really think about it, you know, we've all had spiritual experiences. So we sometimes think of ourselves as physical, having a spiritual experience, when in fact, actually, at our core, we're spiritual beings having a physical experience. That's what this life is. A physical experience. 20 years, 60 years, 120 years, we hope, right? However long we get. But it's a physical experience of our spiritual being is having a physical experience. So we're a soul before we're born. And then we live in our bodies, and we shed our bodies, and we're a soul after we die. But so we have to ask, what's the point of coming through? What's the point of wearing this and living here? It's all about using this tool to transform the soul. So we have the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs really are physical pathways to spiritual transformation. That's really the definition of a mitzvah. It's a connector. It's something to do physically that makes a spiritual impact. So all the do's are about transform your soul this way, grow this way. And all the don'ts are protect your soul this way. Don't engage in this, that's diminishment. So don't diminish this way, do grow that way. How do you engage in the physical world? How do you use? And that's what the Torah is all about. If you want to know what it is, it's not a guidebook for the best life, although the truth is life is pretty good if you keep it. I was just asking my husband today why he's observant. Why does he keep the Torah? And he said, I'm not really sure today. I said, well, why in college when you chose to keep it, did you choose? He said, well, I thought it would give me a better life. I said, well, I think we could look back from now till college and say, yeah, it did give you a better life. You know, your actual physical life here on earth is so far better through keeping it. But there's all kinds of spiritual things too. He's not as into the spiritual stuff as I am. But the actual physical everyday life is better. But it's not just about that. It's about how do we engage. The Torah is about how do we use the physical to transform the spiritual. So what it does is work for us on many different levels. So that's why I put here inner, outer, national, international. Right, so inner, so it works on the inner level. How do we work with our inner selves for transformation and for working things out in life? I personally have, thank God, had sometimes people say, how did you train for your job? Are you a social worker? Do you have a background? No, God trained me. God gave me a lot of custom designed workshops to train me into this job, from challenging children to other situations in life that have been difficult. But the way that I see it now at 49, looking back and with much more understanding, I really do see them as lovingly custom designed workshops for my best soul's growth. Right? So when I first had my first ADD, crazy frenetic child who was all over the place, had a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, wild child, and baby twins, right? So four and under, and you know what that's like. I don't know if you know what it's like to have a crazy wild child as one of them, right? But when I had those four at that time, and my husband and I would divide up, you know, somebody would take somebody shopping and leave the other one home or whatever it was either the 4-year-old and the twins or the 3-year-old, because that was equal work.
Oh my.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he was like that much, right? So I spoke to my Rebbetzin about this child, and she said, you know, it's a test. And I'm like, okay, it's a test. I'm dealing with this test. Okay, so I'm working with that. I'm dealing with the test. And then my father came to visit, and he's like, what is up with this kid? I said, it's a test. He's like, what do you get if you pass the test? And I was like, I don't know. So I had to go back to my Rebbetzin. What do I get if I pass? It's not about passing the test. We talk about tests. It's not about passing tests. It's about how do you grow through this? What you get if you go through the test is a bigger you. Right? The prize for passing is who you are on the other side. So sometimes God opens the door and invites you into a custom design workshop. And sometimes you say, you know what, I'm not that interested in that one. And sometimes God says, I know better, and I think you need to go through this. So in you go, and you get tossed into the chasm. But if you can swim to the other side, what you get is a bigger, stronger, more wise, more capacious, hopefully more patient, loving, kind you in every step of the way. So that's the inner world, and I could never, so that's why I want to start with, I've had lots of these workshops, I could never have done any of these workshops without the Torah tools that I have, without the working on peace, working on confidence, working on trust, knowing that it's custom designed. If I would have thought for a minute that any of it was random or capricious, you know, there are some people who just think God is mean, and he just likes to play jokes, and he has a good time laughing at your expense and giving you whatever it is. That would be miserable to believe, right? Even if I just thought it was random and I just was somehow stuck with difficult pits or health issues or whatever it is, financial stuff or learning stuff or all those things put together in one pile, it would be too much to bear. But if you would know that if I can work with this, and I can because it was gifted to me, I can make it through, and I can help them grow and help me grow through the whole thing. So it definitely makes a difference for one's inner world. And there are mitzvot that have to do with the inner world. How do you work with the inner world? There's prayer. And there's patience, and there's anger management, and all kinds of things within our Torah that talk about inner world. Then there's outer world mitzvahs. How do we deal with people in our lives, the circumstances of our lives, business in our lives, weights and measures, being honest and true, interest, taking revenge, judging others, all kinds of things about our outer world. How do we deal with those in that outer world? Then there's national world, right? How do we come together as a nation? Right? There's mitzvahs that have to do with coalescence of a nation. Think about the Pesach Seder. That's the classic time when we pass on our tradition from one generation to the next. I think there's a very interesting thing that it's just to think about. I'm sure all of you at the Seder, you have Elijah's cup, right, in the middle of the table. What is that for? Anybody know? I'll give you, this is my own thought on it, but I think you'll see that it fits in nicely. What is that cup for?
Elijah.
Right, for Elijah to come and drink from the cup. I know my kids
for
sing.
The future. I mean,
we all come.
I think
from.
It's a tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi will come and drink from it, right?
Good. So Eliyahu HaNavi will come. And many people do think he comes each year to drink from it. So that is not the case. So we do not believe in Santa Claus. Eliyahu is not coming to have a little sip of wine at our Seder table. Although my kids sing the song or sang when they were little, don't shake the table, don't shake the table, watch that cup of wine, because I want to see the wine go down when it's Eliyahu's time. Right? So that reinforces the absolutely incorrect. Right? So no, he doesn't come drink from it. So really, what is it? We do have a tradition that Eliyahu will come in the end of days. And one of the jobs that he's going to do, in addition to heralding the coming of the Messiah, is going to answer questions. There's a lot of stuff we forgot. So, and we don't know how it works, but he'll answer those questions. One of the things that we don't know is how many cups of wine to drink at the Seder. Now, you'll all say four, because we all drink four, right? But actually, it's a question if we should drink four or five. So there's five languages of redemption. And the fifth language, there's I'll take you out, I'll redeem you, I'll save you, I'll make you mine, I'll take you unto myself. I'm just trying to remember loose translations here. I'll take you unto myself as a nation. Right? So the first four happened already when we came out of Egypt. And the fifth one didn't happen yet. We haven't been taken into the land for the ultimate time yet. So, but they're all in the same, like, two verses all in a row. So the question is, how we drink one cup for each one of those words. So we for sure drink one for all the ones that happen. And we have a question, do we drink one for the fifth or not? We forgot. So what we do is we pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. It's a compromise. Because we forgot. forgot what the law is. But we put it in the middle of the table, and we mark it Eliyahu's cup, because he'll answer the question when he comes. Why is this important? It's important because what it means is, in the center of the Seder table is a big question mark. Right? So in the middle of the Seder table, if you really understand this, this is my own thought, and if you really understand it, what we're saying is, I don't know all the answers. And I'm going to put it right out there in the middle of the Seder table. I don't know it all. But it's not going to stop me from passing on what I do know. We have a Seder every year, and we pass on what we know. And part of what we pass on is, I don't know everything, but it's known. Just, I don't know it. And even if somebody next to me doesn't know it, Eliyahu does, and he's going to come and tell us. But just because I don't know doesn't mean I can't pass on. Just because I don't know doesn't mean I'm not going to be Jewish. Just because I don't know doesn't mean I'm not going to keep customs and traditions and laws. I'm going to say I don't know, and I'm still going to do whatever I do know. But I could pass that on with the question mark right smack there in the middle. So the nationals, that's what we're talking about, is the coalescence of nations. So nationhood coalesces at the Seder, and we have a function, we have a job as a nation, not just as individuals, to interact with self and interact with others in a respectful, honest, true, and just way, but as a nation to set, really to try to change the world through that. So first, to create a functioning nation. So it's interesting that as we're not just a religion, we actually have a job to create a nation. And it's not just about being a critical mass of people. It is about creating a nationhood and trying to put all of this stuff into practice, soul transformation practices at work in the everyday, right? So how one practices law, how one drives a bus, how one sweeps the streets, how one cleans their kitchen, how one sells stuff, how one weighs stuff. All of that is part of how do we transform our souls with the everyday? How do we use the physical to grow our spiritual? So we are supposed to create a nation. So it's interesting just to think about the role of law in the world and how law works, particularly national law in this case. So let's just think about Saudi Arabia. We could think about Egypt right now. It's in the middle of a lot of stuff. But let's think about Saudi Arabia for a minute. Saudi Arabia. Are women free in Saudi Arabia? Can they do whatever they want in Saudi Arabia?
No.
Absolutely not. Why not?
The law forbids it.
The law forbids it. Right? And they enforce it well, right? They have bad laws and good enforcement in Saudi Arabia, and women are not free. What about Mexico? Are women free in Mexico?
Yes.
Almost, but not quite. They're not completely free because it's dangerous there. They have good laws in Mexico, but bad enforcement, right? So women are not completely free in Mexico. What about in Canada and the United States? Yes, right? We have good laws and good enforcement, but our laws are so good that most of us agree to keep them because we see they're true and just and fair. And the enforcement's only necessary around the edges, right? Most of us agree to live within the laws. We all agree that we should be driving safely. There's a little camera there to remind you that if you try to run the yellow, you'll get snapped. But so that's just the enforcement around the edges, just to keep you in your agreement, really. But you do agree that there's a way to drive to keep everybody safe and yourself too, and you want to drive that way. So there is enforcement around the edges where it's necessary. But we have good laws and good enforcement, and that makes us free. To the extent that the laws are good and to the extent that there's good enforcement, we're free. So if you think about the laws of the Torah, you could understand through this parable that good law frees people. Good law creates a free and just society where there's the recognition of the inherent dignity of every human being. And the laws that we have are empowering also and really do try to bring people to levels where they can work in a synergy among each other. So the Torah's laws are about creating synergy, are about creating a just society, a society that's just, that people can then see so that we can, through our nationhood, change the world. That is the point of the land of Israel. the point of, we have a nation of Israel. Right now our nation is still dispersed. But really, ideally, we're all supposed to be living in the land of Israel, and it should be then a state of Israel. The state of Israel currently is a state of Jews, but it's not yet a Jewish state, really. Not yet. Hopefully it will be, but it's not quite yet. We struggle of what Jewish state is. But it is certainly a state of Jews at this point. But the ideal, the Torah's ideal, is that it should be a Jewish state. It should be a state where the government and the police and the lawyers and the teachers and the whoever it is, everybody from every part of society is behaving in a way that there's synergy, honesty, straightness, that it makes the society work. Everybody's respected, everybody's educated, everybody contributes according to their ways. In a way, it's really a socialist type of ideal, not socialism, but the concept of everybody contributing according to their capacity and receiving according to their needs. Really, that's a utopian vision that the communists and the socialists kind of felt from us. The Torah is emanating those vibrations. And ultimately, that will come to be, not in a communist or socialist way, but it will be that we all contribute according to our capacity, and that we all have what we need in order to contribute and live in a fair and just way, and pleasant way. So once we establish that in that space, which is our job, then the light from there should shine bright enough that it emanates to the whole world and people start to see, wow, look at that nation. Look at that society. Look at those people. Look at those marriages. Look at the childbearing. Whatever they have, I want it. And people should look at us. I was just in Seattle where that happened. It's happening in little pieces. But there are two black couples that recently converted and got married in the Seattle community. It's interesting because one is, let's see, the man's name is Nisim Black and his wife Adina. And Adina's sister, I forgot her name, was dating somebody named Mr. Brown. And so Adina's sister, Mrs. Black, talked to her sister, who was dating Mr. Brown, and they both converted and got married. So they have the blacks and the browns. Brown. Yeah. But the Seattle community lives on the edge of a black neighborhood. And it started with Mr. Black, who is a rapper, Nisim now, goes by Nis, the Sephardic community there. So he was watching the Jews walk to shul with their children on Shabbos, and he thought, look how nice that is. Fathers walking with their children. It's such a nice family life, and he saw it every week. You know, families walking together, and from the edge of the black community, he thought, I want that. I want to be a father of children that walk together, that are a family. And so he investigated, how is it that these people have that? What gives them that? And he chose to convert to Judaism, brought his wife along with it, and then she brought her sister, and who brought her boyfriend, and now they have these two couples in the community. So that is really what it's supposed to be, that eventually we shine a light that is bright enough that it starts to attract people. And we do attract people, and we do accept converts. We set a bar kind of high for converts, because you have to be willing to then be a light shiner. It's not just about yourself, right? If you want to be Jewish, you're somebody who has to shine, to help other people create their path in the world too. So that's what the Torah is. All the mitzvahs are really about, how do you set up an inner world that is comfortable, stable, growthful, striving? How do you set up an outer world that is fair and just and kind? How do you set up a national world that is synergistic? How do you set up then an international world that can work that way? So, I just want to tell you, we'll get to, let me just give you a quote. I'm recently just learning from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. I think he's just I don't know if it's changed yet. Did they just switch? I don't know, Chief Rabbi of England, Lord Jonathan Sacks. A very articulate man, very interesting. So I've watched some debates and conversations that he's had on YouTube, particularly with Richard Dawkins, who I have a very hard time with. but Chief Rabbi Sacks did a very nice job speaking to him, but Richard Dawkins doesn't actually want to listen to have conversations, really. He has got like lots of pre-recorded bites that he's just able to pull up when he hears a trigger word, that sentence comes out, rather than engaging in real conversation. Just my take on it. Anyway, Rabbi Sacks said something very nice about science and religion. which I think is worth quoting. It's something just to think about in terms of the relationship. But he said that science, and Jews do not, there are Jews that have, Judaism does not have a problem with science at all, whatsoever. And it's a Christian thing, and those Jews who have bought into some Christian paradigms of being at loggerheads, science and religion, so there are people who are making mistakes and are against science, but that is not Jewish. Jews are into science as a religion. It's we recognize a world. There are some scientists who are against religion too. That's a problem. But as a concept of exploring the natural world and understanding how it works, we very much are behind that. So what he describes is the two different roles that science and religion play. I just thought it's such a nice sentence that science describes the world that is, and religion talks about the world that ought to be. And I really like that as a way to think about it, that there is something that describes the natural world and how it works, genetics and what it should be like. But genetics and what it should be like doesn't talk about what you might do with it. So it's interesting, I just watched a TED Talk on deep brain stimulation. He was talking about different areas that you can work on with deep brain stimulation, which is really electric shock therapy, but on a much higher level, or let's say a much deeper level, where they implant electrodes into your brain. They've learned different areas where they can, if they could turn up or turn down areas of the brain, they can affect you. So Parkinson's disease, turn on the ability to control, the shakes stop. Right? They showed another physical disorder where they were able to, with deep brain stimulation, completely transform a little boy's life and body, how it worked. And then they talked about depression. What if you can, they showed a brain scan, what if you could turn down the sadness zone and turn up the motivation zone? How great would that be? Right? And you could really transform somebody with drug-resistant depression. So, and then he said, what about smarts? What about intelligence? Well, let's start with Alzheimer's, where people are losing their intelligence. Yes, they can fix it. What, though, if you just want to be smarter? Really, what happens? So science can help you fix that stuff. Then there's the ethics of what should you be doing in order to, should you be making super geniuses? Should you use technology like that if you can figure it out to make smart people smarter? Or what about stupid people? Normal. And when would you regulate? Who gets to have that? Only the rich people get to be made smarter? So we create a wider gap of achievement and ability, or what? Like, how do we use, that's where religion comes in. That's where morals and values has to come in. It can't just all be science. You have to have science that can figure out how to do it, and religion to figure out what to do with it. Really, there has to be something that guides the pathway there. Okay, I think I'm going to skip the, well, I won't. Okay, so this Ethics of Our Fathers in 5:22, chapter 5, Mishnah 22. It's an interesting description of, and I'm not even really going to fully go into it. It talks about Abraham's students and Bilam's students. So and it compares their students. It's interesting that it says these are the three character traits that you would see in the students of Abraham. These are the three character traits you'd see in the students of Bilam. And it sets up opposites, right? So it does not compare Abraham and Bilam. It compares their students. Why? Because you can see by what their students do, what the teacher was really thinking. So I wish I would know, and if anybody knows a better expression, I will use an expression that's borrowed from another religion, by their fruits shall you know them. Is there a Jewish expression that means that? Like from the fruit of the tree, you can tell what the tree is really. So
apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
It's not that. It's not that. Because the reason why I want to use an expression like that, by your fruit shall you know them, is to look at different religions on the planet. Right? Look at the fruits of Christianity. Look at the fruits of Islam. Look at the fruits of Judaism. And then you can see which is a strong and healthy path. Doesn't mean we don't have a lot of stuff. We have stuff. We have calcification. We have difficult things. But if you look at the fruit, right, we have never fought somebody in a mean way to try to bring them to our side. That's not how Jews do things, right? Our plan to take over the world, because we do have one, is education, right? Universal education. We understand that education empowers. And so we want to create education that's accessible to all. Because we understand that every single person created in the image of God, if you'll educate them and recognize their inherent human dignity, you'll be able to thereby elevate them, and there will be a synergy of us all being able to work together. That's our plan, is buy-in, and that's how we work, right? As Jews, we don't try to take over other people's countries. We don't try to mush our ideas onto people. We try to educate, to empower, to elevate, to help, to assist. So, and you can see by the fruits of some other religions, the way that what their teaching is and how it develops over the ages, some is more comfortable than others, and some is worse than others. So I'll let you take that where you want to go with it. But let's just look at this last little bit. So another quote from Rabbi Sacks, what I really liked, and I don't, he has a PhD, and of course ordination as well. I'm not as smart or as educated as he is. So I don't really understand what Greek tragedy means when he says that Judaism is the triumph of hope over tragedy. And he means that in the Greek tragedy way. I did look up on Wikipedia tragedy and some different definitions for it and really what it means. And I think it really, it doesn't even matter if we understand it in the classical Greek sense. I still think that Judaism is the triumph of hope over any type or any definition of tragedy. And just the fact that we are sitting here today is the triumph of hope over tragedy. If you look at our history and we're here today and we have a bunch of women excited about having gone to or about to go to Israel, our land, our people going together, that's totally the triumph of hope over tragedy, for sure. But Judaism is all about the triumph of hope over tragedy, that we see what is and we keep in mind what can be. And we want to transform ourselves, our families, and the world into what can be. And so we have these five different principles that are completely different from the world that was when Judaism started. And we've brought many of them to the world today. These are principles that are identified by Rabbi Ken Spiro in his book, World Perfect, if you're ever interested in looking at that book.
You just had that.
Yeah. So just quickly, then, you've heard this, but it's just interesting to think about inherent human dignity, that everybody has an inherent human dignity, no matter what they can contribute, no matter who they are, how much they make, what they look like, how able-bodied they are, there is an inherent human dignity in every single human being. I personally have a grandson with Down syndrome. I have a son who unfortunately just passed away with mental illness. And I have a son-in-law who's a quadriplegic in a wheelchair. Each person has still their inherent human dignity, even though one can't move his body, hardly they can move enough to eat and drink by himself, which is nice, but he can't open the fridge by himself and put something in the microwave, right? So I always answer the phone when he calls because my daughter works and he's home. And I mean, he works too, and he goes in and out of the house. But sometimes when he calls, like, you never know what he needs, you know. One time he calls and said, Ema, do you have a minute? I'm like, what? He said, do you have a minute to come over? Usually he'll say, do you have a minute to help me with lunch? And I can say yes or no. Like somebody else, he could call somebody else. But here he just said, do you have a minute to come over? I was like, sure. So I got there. He said, I called all the men I know. I'm really sorry. But he said, I tried getting up from bed. He can sit up and he can somehow hoist himself into his wheelchair, but he missed. And he couldn't recover. And he was just stuck. And he did not want, like, he didn't want his mother-in-law coming over and seeing him, like, half on the bed and half off the bed, but he couldn't, not, like, he tried. And he just couldn't. So I helped him up, and, like, and he's, you know, he's a yeshiva guy, black and white with this hat and everything, but, you know, when that happens, of course, I have to touch him and hold him and pick him up and hoist him, tuck his shirt in and rearrange his pants and pull those pants legs down and put on his shoes and tie them, and then again, shomer negiah after that, you know, not touching. So, and there is still in him the personality, the sense of humor, the light that he has, the beautiful relationship that he has with my daughter. There's inherent human dignity. It has nothing to do with how his body works. In fact, it's elevated by how his body doesn't work. But the point is inherent human dignity. We believe in it as Jews, and we accord it to every living being. Education. Universal education. The United States of America, actually, is the only Judeo-Christian country on the planet. I don't know how Canada holds itself, but the United States is a Judeo-Christian country, not because there's Jews there, because they have Judeo-Christian values. So one of those values is universal education. It's the first country on the planet that had universal, free, compulsory education. That's a Jewish idea. that there should be universal education, that it should be free, and that it should be mandatory. Right? That's not an option. We choose to have a society that's educated, and we choose to make it possible. No, you cannot keep your 10-year-old home to work your farm because you need extra hands. They have to go to school because we will have a society of educated people because that empowers. And that's a Jewish idea. And that came through in American values. Peace. The idea that Canada's not trying to get America and America's not trying to get Canada. We live next to each other in peace and synergy. And the concept that there could be such a thing on the planet is first a Jewish concept, was not a concept of the ancients, but is a concept that we have spread slowly to the globe, that there could be such a thing as people living next to each other in peace. Justice and equity, equality, that there should be such a thing as blind justice, that it shouldn't matter if you're rich or poor, if you're landed, if you're white, if you're black, if you're free, if you're ugly, if you're pretty, if you're a widow, if you're an orphan, there should be justice. That's a blind justice. And even Greek blind justice, I'm sure if you heard Rabbi Spiro, was not blind. It was blind for white men that were educated. But it wasn't blind for women or slaves. Definitely saw that you were that, and so you don't get it. So that's a Jewish concept that's been spread to the world. And then social responsibility, that we take care of each other. It's interesting that in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, they actually had to put a moratorium on conversion for a while because everybody was starving. But Jews, even hungry, share with each other. And so the peasants around them realized if we'd be Jewish, we'd get a little something. So people were converting for a potato, basically. You know, so they did have to put a moratorium on conversions to say, no, it's not about we'll share with you if you become one of us. But we do share with one of us. We do feel that sense of responsibility one to another, which is why you visited an orphanage or an army base or whatever, because it's us. And we want to see that. And we want to support it. And we want to feel it. We are a nation together. I have a friend who made Aliyah a couple of years ago. She's in her 60s. And she was walking across the street. She fell. And she said that before she hit the ground, somebody was there to put something under her head. Somebody else was there offering her a bottle of water. Somebody else wanted to know why at her age she's wearing shoes that high. Somebody else wanted to know where she lives. And a fifth person said he can get her twice the apartment for half the money. We're such a family, you know, we can't help but give to each other and annoy each other like siblings do, you know, but we really do feel that sense of responsibility one for another, and we do exude that to others that people should see. This is what responsibility is. You know, think about all the Maimonides and Beth Israel and Sinai hospitals that are all over the place. I don't know when the last time, there's also St. Joseph's, and, you know, that, I don't know when the last time you heard of Muhammad Hospital. I haven't seen one of those, not on this continent anyway. But we do. We're about giving. We're about healing. We're about helping. That's what we do. You know, jump on a plane with a team of doctors and fly to Haiti and set up, you know, and help. Figure out how to irrigate the Negev, bring it to Africa, right? Figure out how to circumcise adults because we have a bunch of Russian immigrants who need to be circumcised. Take that knowledge, again, to Africa because now we figured out that that helps stem the tide of AIDS. And now adults are lining up to be circumcised there. And who knows how to do it? We do. So we'll share, right? We are about helping. So these are all Jewish values. And once we live them and share them, it does start to shine a light that helps us be a light unto the nations. And that helps us not just transform self, but transform the world. And that's what we're about. And that is the plan of Judaism.
So. Thank you very much.
Sure, pleasure. If you have any questions.
Could you, I'm curious what you mean that we're a state of Jews but not a Jewish state. I wasn't sure what you meant by that.
It's not yet a state that's run with the Jewish laws in mind. There's a lot of Jewish culture and customs, but it's not yet a Torah-run state. So it's not yet really Jewish. It's Jewish culturally, like the Jewish hotels in the Borscht Belt. It's Jewish. It's very Jewish. Like Jackie Mason. It's Jewish. But it's not yet Jewish. It's not yet really what it's supposed to be. We're not yet... We are struggling still culturally as Jews, trying to figure out how Jewish do we want to be. You know, do we want to sacrifice being Jewish for democratic, or do we want to sacrifice being Jewish for being modern? How can we be modern and Jewish? How can we work with secular and religious together? How can we work with anti-religious together? How many immigrants should we be taking in, and from where? How Jewish do those immigrants have to be? You know, all that stuff is still, we're still working it out. And really the government is not turning to Torah sources to try to figure out answers to that. It's really modern sources or their own ideas or their own collection of ideas that are finding answers to that. So it's not yet Jewish in its underlying essence of how the state should run. It's Jewish because there's a lot of Jews there.
Hmm. But there's also lots of... Well, they said that in a few years the Arabs will outgrow the...
So there are some people who are using those kinds of scare tactics. It's not true. I mean, there are people who there are Muslims. There are Jews too, Muslims who use this kind of language. They talk about the weapon of the womb, and understanding it as a weapon, right? Uh-huh. But there are also Jews who understand that facts on the ground make a difference. And so not only do we want to have large families for our own self, but I remember I lived in Israel from 1980 to 84. And I did some work. I served in the army for 2 years, and I worked at Hadassah Hospital for a little while. I wanted to go to medical school, so I was hoping that getting my name on some papers through research would help me get into medical school. Didn't end up doing that. But I did work at Hadassah Hospital doing research with a bunch of mice, killing a lot of mice through giving them drug overdoses and then trying to rescue them. But I remember speaking to some of the secular staff there. One woman, a researcher, I think probably a PhD, who was pregnant with her fourth, and she told me, of course she's having four. Now that's her responsibility as a Jew in the Jewish state, is to have at least four, which is just very clear. It was like a Zionistic thing to do. It didn't have to do with religion. It had to do with her responsibility as a Jew in this state. Is four is a minimum. So, and it really made an impression on me that she was very clear, and she was not at all, you know, halachically adherent, but she was very clear that four is a minimum standard. That's what Jews do. Mm-hmm. So,
can you share with us how many you have?
I have six. Four. I have six. Just buried one, unfortunately. So I just lost a son, but gave birth to six.
Oh,
so.
I knew this from reading this. That's right. Yeah, uh-huh. Sorry.
Uh-huh. I have an article I wrote about that's going to be on H.com next week. So you can read that if you want. But, yeah. So what was the question? I just wanted to make sure I fully answered. I forgot.
About the Muslims.
Yes, right. Okay, so people do say, but the Muslims also, as they're experiencing some more contact with the West, more information, more contact with the Internet, and a little bit more affluence, their birth rate is actually going down. It is going down. They have more access to birth control too. So their birth rate is going down. Not everybody has 12. It's just not true what they say. They want to create this whole scare tactic, but it's not true. Jews are having, and right now it's interesting to look at who's making aliyah to Israel is pretty much only religious, and who's leaving Israel is largely the not religious. It is shifting the tide of who lives in Israel.
My two kids made aliyah.
Oh yeah? Yeah? Very nice.
Soon by you.
Yeah. At the right time.
when I see them settle there,
then you'll follow.
Could I ask you, if I'm correct, then in all of history there's never been a time when all the Jews were observant. Do you see a time in the future? Do you think that all the Jews will have to become observant?
Well, that's two different questions. Do I think that they'll have to become? I don't think that in order to have it, we'll have to become. I do think that we probably will become, because I think we'll at some point get it. You know, just like we say at the end of Aleinu, on that day, God's name will be one, right? And He will be one and His name will be one. He is one already. So what are you saying? On that day, He'll be one. And His name will be one. His name is not yet one. We use a lot of different names throughout the nations. Okay, that I get. But what is it? God will be one. It's our perception of God will be one. All of our eyes, Jews and non-Jews, will turn the kaleidoscope so that we'll see it so clearly. And because we'll get it, God will be one instead of so fractionated. So that will make a difference in our desire. Right? So just like it does, I mean, just think about everything else that we do. and struggle with. I think we'll probably still struggle, but just let's take nutrition as an example. Right, so all of us here have basic information about nutrition and food and how it works in our bodies. And we all know if you eat this, you look that way and feel that way. And if you eat that, you're going to look that way and feel that way. And many of us who may have a few extra pounds or a few dozen extra pounds know that if they'll eat less chocolate, they'll have less pounds. And yet chocolate's right there and it's so good. So the knowledge makes a difference. It definitely does. And it motivates me. And if I'll spend time learning more about nutrition and how it works and how it functions in my body, like I'll take some more fish oil and I'll eat some less chocolate and I'll try to exercise some more and I'll slip back too because it's so much easier to be sedentary and eat chocolate. You know, like my favorite exercise really is chewing and turning pages. I mean, that's what I
So want you to be, all of us, to be healthy. So it's not...
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's not
made the chocolate.
No, for sure God wants us to be healthy. So that's what I'm saying. Like the more I learn, like if I'll really spend some time learning more about how God really does want me to be responsible for the body that he gifted me with and use it as a tool to grow my soul, and I'll see that chocolate sometimes fits and sometimes does not fit in with that program, then I could eat less. But it's very easy to slip away from that. It's like you go to the dentist and you floss every day for a week, and then I don't know, maybe not every day after that. Right? You need that inspiration again and again and again to really do what's good all the time. So I think that the knowledge will make a difference when we see it, and I think we'll still struggle with, it's not always so easy to do what you know is right and good, and even what you want to do.
True.
Right? Even what you want to do. You know, I remember nursing in the middle of the night, and I had terrible thrush, which is really a yeast infection, right, which is fed by sugar. So at night, I would be nursing and in so much pain. That's when I used my Lamaze breathing, like, you know, because more for nursing than from childbirth, because it hurts so much. And in the middle of the night, I'd swear, I'm never having sugar again. Never, ever, ever. I'm not going to touch it. In the morning, I'd get up and have the cookies for breakfast. You know, it's like, so like, so it's still, there's a physical that pulls, even when you want it, right? Somebody who's addicted to cigarettes, they still smoke it, even though they want to quit. So I think we will still struggle with that. Will we be fully observant? Even if we want it, we'll still struggle with always doing it. That's part of being physical. But at least we'll be striving in a different direction.
Maybe if more people are observant, it will become easier because, for instance, let's say more restaurants would be kosher.
Absolutely.
Or more places to buy kosher food.
Mm-hmm.
Tariffs going up so you can walk and carry.
Yes.
You know, like a lot of that.
Yeah.
Like for us to keep kosher on that trip we were on, how hard was that?
We met in Hawaii.
Yeah,
for
Pesach.
Right.
For Pesach vacation, and it was 5-star delicious.
Uh-huh.
It was
right.
Not a hardship.
We all gained weight. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. Exactly. I think it will make a big difference, and certainly living in community makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. It really does. I mean, think about Shabbos and how great Shabbos is if you live in a community. It's almost impossible outside of community. But in community, everybody lives in walking distance of the shul, which means they live in walking distance of each other, which means all the kids who keep Shabbos live right next to each other or within blocks of each other. The kids know what to do on Shabbos. They travel in packs from house to house getting candies from everybody, right? And the adults know what to do on Shabbos. Take a nap whenever you can, right? But their friends know that that's nap time, but you also have the meal time, which is everybody has that time set in their schedule. So you know you can invite somebody over for a 2-hour or a 3-hour meal of chatting and relax with nobody having any place else they have to go. And so everybody's relaxed and can enjoy it, and all your friends are doing that. Mm-hmm. So it makes a total difference when you're in community doing that, and the schedules are set up for it, and the kids are set up for it, and there's activity groups for the kids in the afternoon so that the parents can rest, and the older kids walk the younger kids. And, you know, it just makes a huge difference when it's set up for it, for sure. And when it's not, it's much harder. No question about it.
Yeah, it can be lonely, if, as you said, if there's a community.
Yeah.
And obviously,
yeah. I saw a fabulous invention. Somebody made an Aruv hat. So it was a black hat with sticks poking out of it and a string around it. So wherever he went, it was in the Aruv. Not kosher, but cute.
That's really cute.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much to everybody.